Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 29-year-old alleged Russian spy, Maria Butina, who appeared in federal court in Washington, D.C. today on charges of conspiracy and acting as an illegal foreign agent in the United States. Naveed Jamali, a senior fellow in the program on national security at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, who spent 3 years as a civilian double agent with the FBI and is the author of How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent, joins us. We'll discuss Butina's efforts to infiltrate Republican politics under the guidance of Russian spies with support from an oligarch close to Putin and her use of a 56-year-old American activist in Republican and conservative circles who she lived with who provided political access. We'll explore how many tentacles there were and are to this ongoing Russian operation to influence our elections and look into evidence that Butina was being used as a lure by her paymaster, the Russian oligarch Alexander Torshin, to infiltrate the NRA so that Russian money could be funneled into the Trump campaign. And given that the Russians hacked into the private data of the DNC, Hillary Clinton, and her campaign manager, we will assess how that valuable information was likely used in real time by Americans yet to be identified, who would have given Trump the ability to not just read Hillary's private thoughts and strategies, but anticipate her every move and political message. Then we'll examine the efforts by Maria Butina to infiltrate a secret Christian political group of American Christian nationalists as well as gun rights groups to covertly promote Russian interests. Jeff Charlotte, a professor of English at Dartmouth College and author of The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power, and C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy, joins us to discuss why Maria Butina was able to toss softball questions to candidate Trump and try to set up meetings with him and Putin. And since she tried to infiltrate both the NRA leadership and the leadership of the National Prayer Breakfast, which is organized by the Secretive Fellowship Foundation, we will investigate ties between America's religious right and Russia's religious right. Then finally, following a $5.1 billion fine levied against Google by the European Union, we'll look into why antitrust efforts in Europe are much more vigorous and effective than they are in the United States. Matt Stoller, a fellow at the Open Markets Institute who previously spent 6 years on Capitol Hill, most recently as a senior policy advisor to the Senate Budget Committee, joins us to discuss the lobbying power of the tech giants and the need for the American people to recognize the growing power of tech monopolies and the dangers posed to us from the business models of surveillance capitalism practiced by Google and Facebook. And joining us now is Naveed Jamali, who's a senior fellow in the Program on National Security at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He spent 3 years as a civilian double agent with the FBI, then joined the U.S. Navy as a reserve intelligence officer, where he continues to serve. He is a regular contributor to MSNBC and The Daily Beast, and the co-author of How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent. Welcome to Background Briefing, Naveed Jamali.
Thank you, Ian.
And it's pretty clear that the Russian spy has been caught, albeit a young woman who appears to be a protege of a oligarch, but apparently she did have a meeting with somebody that appears to be an intelligence officer attached to the Russian embassy in Washington, D.C. So what do you make of Maria Butina?
You know, Ian, this is something that I felt for a long time has been really misunderstood by both the press and frankly Americans. You know, it really goes back to this idea that the Russians have somehow cooled their heels at to close the Cold War, and anything can be further from the truth. It also, as we look at the indictments and we look at the 2016 Russian meddling in our election, there's this reaction that somehow this was done either behind a keyboard in Moscow or that this was some sort of cyber activity. But really what I believe, and where this ties into Maria, is that what the Russians rely on heavily, from my experience, is human beings. They rely on human assets. So Maria is, frankly, just the tip of the iceberg of what I know to be a fairly deep and robust network that the Russians have operating in the United States. It's just an example, the latest example, of someone who's operating in the United States under the direction.
Well, she apparently had an affair with actually lived with a Republican political activist, operative, if you will, in South Dakota, and even mentioned to her handler, I guess, who's a Russian oligarch. The Republican operative apparently is Paul Erickson, a 56-year-old veteran of conservative politics and pro-gun right activism from South Dakota. And she apparently expressed disdain for having to live with him to her handler, who's this Alexander Torshin, who's a Russian billionaire close to Putin, and apparently offered to have sex with somebody else in exchange to join an organization which looks like the NRA. So this, I know this is all very salacious, but is this sort of reminiscent of both the TV series The Americans and the Chapman story of the sleeper? And,
of course, and of course. And you know, the Anna Chapman story with this, you know, the this attractive redhead who was accused and eventually convicted of being an illegal, what the FBI calls an illegal. Then returned to Moscow in a trade that involved, unfortunately, the gentleman who was who the Russians attempted to assassinate in the UK, and was then given given a medal. Look, at the end of the day, if we take the salacious details out, what we see here is a pattern of Russian aggression with the intent to infiltrate organizations, and this is nothing different than when you talk about Anna Chapman. What Anna Chapman was in her orders. Her orders were to, and the nine fellow illegals that were arrested alongside with her, her orders were to gain access to various parties with the intent of influence political activities. I mean, this is nothing new, Ian. This has been going on for a very long time, and it's just now, after 2016, that we take it seriously because we see the damage it can do. So, again, if you take the salacious details out of this, what we see here is a concerted effort by the Russians to use people and use whatever means necessary to gain access in order to manipulate and curry favor and, at the end of the day, really influence ways, influence decisions that are positive for Russia.
But it seems that the purpose of infiltrating the NRA had a lot to do with laundering Russian money that may well have gone into the Trump campaign. That seems to be what's going on here. They were using the NRA as a cutout so that they could fund the Trump campaign. That seems to be what Torshin was about. And she seems to be, since she works directly for Torshin, Maria Butina, she seems to be like his lure, if you will.
Well, there's a lot of question about oligarchs and where they fit in. Are they independent operators? Are they, in fact, pawns of Russian intelligence services? And the answer that I've gotten is it's a little bit of both. I mean, clearly their power and their what they've accumulated is owed in large part to Putin, and the fact that they're allowed to retain those trappings is, of course, because of Putin. So it's not a far fetch to believe, and as you saw here in the indictment, that oligarchs are often used by Russian intelligence services. So even if there is a tangible sort of criminal element of just straight money laundering, which I'm sure there are plenty of oligarchs who are involved in nefarious activities, it does not erase the larger claim that I made that the Russian intelligence services are really seeking to gain access and influence of various organizations. And look, you know, the fact of the matter is you keep seeing Russians popping up alongside various, you know, various people, and it's various meetings. You know, this is not by accident. This is not just for criminal enterprise. The fact that these people are connected to Russian intelligence services, to me, shows that there is a larger effort afoot, and it's one that I really believe comes down to the fact that, you know, Russia retains this ideology that sees the United States as their main adversary.
And, of course, the front group that she and Torshin were trying to set up is a Russian version of the NRA, and there's no such thing in Russia of the right to bear arms.
Right.
It's a police state, so there's no way in the world that they're going to allow average Russians to have the kind of arsenals that the average American has access to. And again, I'm speaking with Naveed Jamali, who's a senior fellow in the program on national security at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, who spent 3 years as a civilian double agent with the FBI, then joined the U.S. Navy as a reserve intelligence officer, where he continues to serve. He's a regular contributor to MSNBC and The Daily Beast, and he's the co-author of How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent. So apparently, Butina was handed off, I guess, by the special counsel, Robert Mueller. So I take it he's got more important fish to fry. But there is a connection, is there not, to...
I'm certainly waiting for him to claim her. The other thing that's going to be interesting is if the Russians do, in fact, claim her and say that she's, much as they did with Anna Chapman. It is a curious development that it's not a Mueller indictment, but I would not be surprised if Mueller, comes back to this. This there was also very much a concern of her being a flight risk and wanting to retain her. So this may have just been the easiest course of action to keep her in the United States.
Well, apparently the FBI have received wiretaps obtained by the Spanish police that implicate Donald Trump Jr. in a plot to meet with Alexander Torshin, again, the oligarch who essentially employed or controlled Maria Butina. And apparently there was extensive wiretapping done of both Torshin and Alexander Romanov, who is convicted of money laundering in Spain. And he refers in these recordings, these wiretaps, he refers to Torshin as El Padrino, the godfather. Now, apparently, Russian intelligence tipped off Torshin just before the Spanish police were about to arrest him. So whatever the files of the Spanish police have on both Torshin and Alexander Romanov apparently been turned over to the FBI. So the assumption would be that that'd be something that would interest Mueller, wouldn't it?
Of course. And again, Bob Mueller is not interested in just your traditional white collar or organized crime, right? The assertion here is that there's a nexus that involves a conspiracy between the Russians and members of the Trump circle in regards to the 2016 election in support of Russia's interference operation. So all this stuff has to be driving to that one point. And I think that, again, we're not interested in exposing, or Bob Mueller's not interested in exposing Russian oligarchs who are conducting criminal activity. Rather, he's interested in exposing the mechanisms that may have been used to carry out these acts. And I think that you're starting to see those things. And look, we don't, what I will say about Donald Trump Jr. is at the end of the day, my experience with the Russians, that at some point, we are going to learn that there were Americans who were involved. It's just inconceivable to me that a Russian operation to interfere in our elections would not use Americans. And again, it's a very important distinction to understand between targeting an American. So meeting with an American and having a conversation with an American, is not in of itself a crime. But the simple fact is today we have yet to learn of any of these people any of these Americans who had contact with either Russian intelligence officers or suspected Russian assets who voluntarily disclosed that meeting to the authorities. I mean, to me, that is such a moral, not only just a legal question, but it's certainly one that brings into question the morality and their loyalty to this country. I mean, this is when someone doesn't disclose something, to me, that is an indicator that they have something to hide. And I'm sure that those in law enforcement feel the same way. Now it's just a question of proving if they were, in fact, engaged in activities that rise to the level of criminal.
Well, obviously, some of the people that Maria Butina and Torshin met with, of course, there's a photograph out there of Torshin on one side of Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin and Maria Butina on the other, all smiles. And now we learn a U.S. congressman out here in Orange County, California, Dana Rohrabacher, he had a meeting with her, had a dinner with her, in fact, although he claims that nothing went on. And he, of course, is under suspicion. In fact, his own colleagues in the House, including Kevin McCarthy, in a private meeting said, "I swear to God, Dana Rohrabacher and Donald Trump are on Putin's payroll," at which point immediately Paul Ryan said, don't go any further, shut up, and we'll keep it amongst ourselves. So those suspicions are out there. But I would hope, I mean, that we could get a kind of, you know, like a roadmap. Do you think that we're eventually going to see all of these intricate connections? Because the more of this stuff that turns up, the more you see a multifaceted Russian operation that basically had all kinds of different compartments to meddle with our elections, whether it was direct phishing and hacking, and or at least the potential to hack at the electoral level, the recruitment of the Green Party candidate Jill Stein, the use of the NRA and the White House Prayer Breakfast Fellowship Group, all of these. I mean, is that what you think that Mueller is working on? That, in other words,
yes,
we'll get the big picture at some point or other? Because it seemed to me that Putin had so much redundancy in his influence over the American election that if you even look at just at one component, say that Jill Stein, she basically got more votes than Hillary Clinton in those three key states that she lost by. So on her own, that component of the broader Russian plan was enough to get Trump over the top. So it feels like there were all kinds of tentacles of this operation. Is that your impression?
Yeah, but it is. But I'm also very concerned about overinflating Russian capabilities and what they actually did. What I see, my starting point is this, is that, again, Russia's ideology and Russia's stance towards the United States is that we constitute their premier threat. They see, and so, and as a result, everything that they do from diplomacy to military to intelligence is aligned to hurt the United States. The 2016 elections just simply offered an opportunity to continue on with their ideology. So the starting point for me is that Russia views us as their main adversary. That's it. So when we start kind of delving down, I don't believe that the 2016, you know, was something where they tried to, at the outset, was something to install Donald Trump as president. Rather, I think they were simply looking to harm the United States. So when you start with that premise and you start looking at the tentacles, there are some things that I believe are likely, and there's some things that I think that are probably unlikely. I think that Russia is also incredibly uneasy about direct confrontation. Look, the reason that they did this through intelligence operations, the reason that, as you're saying, will a clear roadmap come forward, is that that's part of the Russians' design. When you run an intelligence operation, you do so for two reasons. One is to carry out the mission, but two is to make sure that it remains clandestine. That is to say that even if it is discovered, in many cases, an operation, you're not even aware that you're the victim of it. But if you are, the ability to make attribution next to impossible. So those are the two things, is the mission and non-attribution. And I think the Russians really carefully planned this out to avoid direct attribution, because they know that that could have risked escalation. When you understand that, then the possibility of them doing certain things, such as changing votes, such as actually attacking systems, that would have changed the nexus considerably in terms of our response. What we're talking about here so far is really traditional espionage activity, stealing stuff, gaining access, trying to influence. And frankly, this is nothing different in terms of tactics than they've done since the Cold War. The difference here is they did it in a very, very aggressive manner, and then they did so with the intent to, frankly, interfere with the presidential election, something I don't believe they've ever done before.
Well, clearly, after he annexed Crimea and started a war with Ukraine and got sanctioned, Putin turned to this form of hybrid warfare as a response. And my sense is that Absolutely. The meeting with Trump was all about, since it was all done in secret, was basically he's trying to find a way, whether or not he owns Trump or not, I don't know, but he's trying to find a way to basically say, you know, I'll stop what I'm doing when you guys take the sanctions off. And that it's a straightforward kind of blackmail, if you will. But when you talk about the tentacles, the fact that they hacked the DNC and the email of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, along with her servers as well, I find it impossible to believe that that extremely valuable information that you would have as a campaign, knowing exactly what the opposition is doing in real time, that never ended up in the hands of the Trump people. Why would the Russian military intelligence hack the DNC if they weren't going to hand that product over?
You're exactly right, that there's a level of what I call targeting data here. But just to be very clear, when the special counsel says hacking, what I take that to be, and he goes into great care in describing what that is. And in terms of hacking for him, that is gaining access to the systems of U.S. persons and entities, and then stealing information and then distributing it without permission. I want to make clear that that is the definition of what is done in espionage. You break into systems, you steal stuff. The difference here is that it was used and given to a third party. The Russians were very, very careful about, you know, whether it be WikiLeaks or the DNC leaks that they actually ran, but they were very, very careful about how they gave it. They didn't want attribution back to them. That's why they used cutouts like WikiLeaks. But you're absolutely right, and I think that's going to be a large basis for this conspiracy. Was this information used by those in the Trump circle? Was it given to them? And if it was, listen, the Russians don't give anything for free. They would have had to have given it to someone with the understanding they were going to get something back. There had to be some discussion. So this is really where this is going, and this is why I think, you know, I'm very confident that at the end of the day there are going to be indictments against Americans, specifically for things that you've laid out. But again, it's just important to understand that when it comes to the Russian threat, you know, this is not a cyber attack. This is the tools of espionage being used in a very different manner, but espionage nonetheless.
Well, Naveed Jamali, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You got it.
And again, I've been speaking with Naveed Jamali, who's a senior fellow in the program on national security at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, who spent 3 years as a civilian double agent with the FBI, then joined the U.S. Navy as a reserve intelligence officer, where he continues to serve. He's a regular contributor to MSNBC and The Daily Beast, and he's the co-author of How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the efforts by Maria Butina to infiltrate a secret Christian and political group of American Christian nationalists. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jeff Charlotte, a professor of English at Dartmouth College and a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine and Esquire, and the best-selling author or editor of 6 books of literary journalism, including The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power, and C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Charlotte.
Hi, Ian. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And what do you make of the appearance in an orange jumpsuit today of Maria Butina in a federal court in Washington, D.C.? She's considered a flight risk. She's being held in jail. She's being charged essentially with being a Russian spy and illegally operating as a foreign agent in this country. She apparently infiltrated or tried to infiltrate the highest levels of the NRA, but also the prayer breakfast, the secretive group that run that, the fellowship, or as you've written about, the family. So why are the Russians interested in the family?
Quite simply, it's the quickest and most efficient backdoor to American power. The family, unlike other Christian right groups that sort of lobby for access to Washington power, the family is comprised of and dedicated to insiders. It's not for the folks out in the heartland expressing their values. It's senators, congressmen, military leaders, business leaders. And so if you are looking for influence in Washington, there is possibly no better religious channel than this organization.
Well, in the 17-page affidavit released on Monday by the DOJ outlining their charges against Maria Butina, it references her dealings with organizers of the National Prayer Breakfast and also the fact that they have this conservative Christian organization have been sending conservative Christian congressmen on multiple trips to Eastern European countries friendly with Russia. She apparently attended at least two of these prayer breakfasts and even invited Vladimir Putin to one in February of 2017. He didn't say no, but he didn't show up.
So. Well, it goes deeper than that. She attended more than two, but she also attends the Moscow Prayer Breakfast, which is a direct offshoot of the National Prayer Breakfast. It was founded in 1992 by Doug Burley, who's the current leader of the family, the National Prayer Breakfast organizer. And in fact, that's where she first met the unidentified person number two, or at least we know that the first meeting that we know of with an unidentified person number two in the affidavit. So this relationship with this organization goes much deeper both ways. I think what's notable is that we're concentrating on Russians infiltrating this organization, and that to me presents a more innocent, naive reading of what the family is. It's worth noting that they are reaching out to her, too. Not only does she attend their events in Moscow, but they actually travel to Moscow to meet with her and her handler, Alexander Torshin, widely believed to be the unnamed Russian official in the affidavit, and a man who's banned from the U.S. They go to meet them. They work with them. They promise them seats. They arrange for the largest ever Russian delegation at the 2017 prayer breakfast. I don't think they're in the dark about what those people want. Even members of the Russian delegation anonymously later tell reporters, we're not here to pray. We're here to do work, for access, to do politics.
Well, she's not exactly an exemplar of Christian values herself, is she? She's a 29-year-old alleged Russian spy. She's living with a 56-year-old Republican activist who she disdains and complains about.
Yes.
And tries to seduce, I guess it's members of the NRA, I think, that she was trying to get a high-level job with them.
Sure, and this is what we know of. I mean, it's not a spy scandal without sex. And, you know, you almost sort of think that maybe she's been watching too many episodes of The Americans and thinking, oh, I guess this is how you do it. But yeah, and I think that's really representative of when these groups like the family or like the Russian government, if you want to call that a group, speak of family values, what they're really talking about is a political tool. They're not talking about something most of them personally subscribe to or even care about that much. The bottom line is power. You know, a friend was asking me, looking at this affidavit, says, I don't get it. Is the Christian right, American Christian right, attracted to Putin because of his anti-LGBT politics, or is it because of anti-Islam? And I would say both and neither, that what it is, it's pro-authoritarianism. And that's really the attraction. And that's at the heart of the theology of the family, which distinguishes them a little bit from other Christian right groups, is that they openly identify their theology is about being one of strength and modeling Jesus. They say you could understand Jesus through looking at strong men in history. They name crazy figures like Hitler and Lenin and Mao, Pol Pot, not because they're Nazis or much less communists, but because they model strength. So Putin is a ready-made figure for them.
And, of course, Putin has brought back the Russian Orthodox Church, and essentially Russia has returned to Tsar Nicholas I's triumvirate of orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationalism.
Well, what's fascinating about that is that Putin uses the Russian Orthodox Church much like Trump uses evangelicalism. Neither of them is really a personally devout man. No one suspects that. Both have a transactional relationship. And, you know, I've attended Trump rallies where you get the crowd and they're roaring because of some really right-wing preacher opening things up with a rip-roaring sermon. And I'm talking to people, no, none of these people are churchgoers, but they love this kind of red, bloody, nationalistic religion. Same in Russia. Not very many people attend church in Russia. They love this idea of a Russian Orthodox Church. They love religion as a sort of a blunt instrument of nationalism. And, you know, again, that's sort of, you almost wonder why Russia had to resort to spies to reach out to the American Christian right, when the American Christian right is, especially groups like Family, which have been cultivating Russian relationships for a long time, has been sort of just begging them, saying, come here, you know, let's be friends, use us. We are your channel into United States power.
Let's then talk more about the ties between America's religious right and Russia's religious right, and the role of the fellowship, the family. They've sponsored 37 trips abroad of members of Congress and in the last 18 years, and 14 of those trips have been by Representative Robert Oldisholt, a Republican of Alaska, who's the co-chair of the 2016 National Prayer Breakfast.
Alabama, I believe, actually.
Oh, Alabama. Sorry. Yeah, Alabama. You're right. Yeah. So what's the agenda? Why was he going to those, particularly those Eastern European countries?
Well, the agenda of the family has always been, you know, for decades, their idea is that Christianity made a mistake for 2,000 years by focusing on everyday people, the regular folks, the poor, and that they believe that they received a message from God. I mean, very literally a message from God telling them that their focus was to be the up and out, that the way you brought about the kingdom of God was not through converting the masses, but by converting the leaders and bringing them into obedience. So in their documents, they refer to the slow work of building this a network of 200 world leaders, bound through the family, through the back channel of the family, into this this kingdom building mission. They've always concentrated, especially on smaller nations to begin with. So they'll work in, I mean, they've been deeply invested in places like Romania and Albania, and bigger nations like Ukraine that have weaker governments, because they can have tremendous outsized influence. We may not be familiar with a congressman like Bob Aderholt, but a representative, just one congressman showing up in a country like Romania is very significant. You mentioned that there's 36 trips and 14 by Aderholt. I should clarify, that's what we know that's on the congressional record. There's quite a bit more than that. Those are the trips that are sponsored by them. There's a number of interlocking 501c3s, and so to really track it down, it's this sort of endless work of finding. They'll create little 501c3s that exist for nothing but sending one congressman to Sri Lanka to talk about an arms deal and Jesus one time. So the travel is really much more extensive, as is the Russia work. The Russia work, which is sort of where they're moving into the heart of a big power. They've established regular prayer cells in the Duma, which is the Russian parliament. And more interestingly, about 30 years ago, or close to 30 years ago, they started bringing up a group of young, promising men and cultivating them. Those men have gone on to become promising business leaders, and they now meet in a regular businessmen's prayer breakfast. So from their perspective, you know, Russia is the prize of all this sort of travel among the smaller Eastern European countries.
Well, if they're only going after the elites, Russia will be the perfect target, because it's run by a handful of oligarchs regulated by the capo di capo, Vladimir Putin. And
exactly. And that's their idea of how a government should be run. So you've got to remember that they don't believe in democracy. They were founded in 1935 with the explicit rejection of democracy. You know, I've traveled with family politicians like Sam Brownback, who's now Trump's ambassador for international religious freedom. Brownback, who was then a senator from Kansas, said, you know, I wasn't elected. I don't represent the U.S. people. I don't represent the people of Kansas. I have one constituent, Jesus. Senator Jim Inhofe, who's current senator from Oklahoma, expresses the same. He's traveled all over Africa, and he says, when I go there, I represent the Jesus thing as taught to me by the family. He doesn't represent the United States.
Yeah, but, but that's not the Jesus in the Bible, though. This is the amazing. How do they get around the fact that...
It is a really unorthodox interpretation of Jesus. You know, there's a little parable that the leader who just... leader for many decades was a man named Doug Coe. He died last year. But in a book, a pro-Trump book, a bestseller during the campaign, explaining why evangelicals should support Trump, had a little parable from Doug Coe about just such figures. He says, look, you know, you can go and you can minister to the sheep, but that's a one-by-one kind of deal. You go to the wolves, and suddenly you're dealing in, because the wolves, you know, scare the sheep, the wolves rule. Now you're dealing with power. And if you go to the leader of the pack, who was this figure that Coe called the Wolf King, and you say to him, if you bring Jesus alongside you, you'll even have more power. The Wolf King's going to cut a deal. The Wolf King's going to say that's a good deal. So this is crazy theology, but that's the theology that they use, for instance, to support Trump. How can you justify, as a Christian, supporting Trump? He's the Wolf King. And he's going to cut deals, just like Putin has. Putin doesn't care about his family values agenda, but Christians like it. Same with Trump. And their idea of building peace through these countries is bringing two strong men together, Putin and Trump together. Their idea, you know, that summit that just happened, that's the family's idea of how international politics should work. Two strong men in a room alone.
Secretly, without notes. Perfect.
No need for notes. Jesus will keep the Jesus will keep the record. You know, their idea is God is using these figures, whether or not these men are devout or not. It's, of course, it's, you couldn't really conceive of a theology that's more self-serving for power. It sort of is, you know, what God wants apparently is whatever Trump wants or whatever Putin wants. And not a whole lot of scriptural consultation is required.
Well,
you know, that's also what makes it really easy for someone like Maria Butina to walk right into this. She can start cultivating. If she had gone to some more traditional Christian right organizations, they would expect her to have some scriptural knowledge. The National Prayer Breakfast, Jesus is a gloss over power. You don't really need to talk faith. You need to talk access. You need to talk big names. And that's exactly what we see in the affidavit. We see her discussing with them which Putin advisors, which senior Putin advisors are we going to bring to the National Prayer Breakfast? Where are we going to put them? And, you know, remember in the affidavit, she talks about thanking the prayer breakfast organizers for that very special private meeting that followed. That's the work that they're doing together.
Well, Jeff Charlotte, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Charlotte, who's a professor of English at Dartmouth College and a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine and Esquire. And he's a best-selling author of six books and literary journalism, books of literary journalism, including The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power, and C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking how Europe has just fined Google $5.1 billion while the U.S. antitrust efforts languish.
Burning Isaac, Jesus coming. Jesus comes to pave the way. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe in the second chance? Do you believe in rapture?
City. I can make it, put your phone down. You ain't gonna text no one when you with me. I can make it, put your phone down. So you can show me attention. And I'll cut mine off too. Boy, that'll help when I listen. I can make it, put your phone down. Baby, we don't need it. Every time you get a message, act like
you don't see it, I can make you put your phone down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matt Stoller, who's a fellow at the Open Markets Institute, who is currently writing a book on monopoly power in the 20th century. Previously, he spent 6 years on Capitol Hill, most recently as a senior policy advisor to the Senate Budget Committee, where he focused on trade, competition policy, and financial services. In addition to his work on the Hill, he's produced for MSNBC and starred in an FX political comedy show with Russell Brand. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Stoller.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Matt, it's almost as though the Europeans are shaming us in terms of dealing with these enormous tech monopolies that are growing in power at an extraordinary rate. I mean, what, 10 years ago, the number one corporation in the world, I think, was ExxonMobil, and now it's Alphabet, Google, and all the other tech companies, Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon, are close behind. So is it right to assume that in maybe another 10 years, they'll be even, what, 10 times more powerful than they are now?
Well, you know, if you had asked me a couple of years ago if Donald Trump would be president, I would have thought it was sort of foolish, crazy. So I'm not very good at predicting the future, but they're really powerful. And I think we're going to deal with them. But if we don't, in 10 years, this will be a very different society.
So specifically, the fine levied by the Europeans against Google is $5.1 billion for abusing their power in the mobile phone market. So why them and not Apple, for example? I thought Apple had a bigger penetration of the market than Android.
So the specific problem that the European Competition Commission was looking at was not Google having a large market share in the mobile phone market, which it does through its ownership of the Android mobile operating system. It said it was using its market share of the mobile licensed mobile operating system to entrench dominance in an anti-competitive manner of its search engine. So it's a tying or bundling case, which is to say it's saying one product, if you buy one product, you're going to be forced to take a different product. So it's not like Apple where they're just selling their phones. You're actually talking about Google giving away an operating system, but forcing the phone makers that use that operating system to also pre-install Google Search.
And I guess that's the sort of portal that gives them so much power, doesn't it? Isn't that essentially dominating the global market, Google Search?
Yeah, that's right. So Google is trying to maintain its dominance in the search market, and it's doing it by paying off telecom companies and also contractual restrictions on phone makers and so on and so forth. That's what the fine was for.
But aren't they also paying off politicians here in the United States, not to put too fine a point on it?
Yeah, I mean, they're doing it in both the U.S. and in Europe. And the Google has, a $300 million grant program for civil society groups, journalists or something in Europe. They give up, you know, they're the biggest lobbying firm in D.C. They, you know, they do, they give huge amounts to academics. So, yeah, I mean, they are a corrupting force, but this is not new, but it's on a pretty significant scale.
And is their motto still "Don't do evil"?
I don't know. maybe even sarcastic air quotes or something.
Right.
The problem isn't that. The problem is the legal context of the institution, right? I mean, their search engine is fine. A lot of their products are fine. The problem is that they're engaged in anti-competitive behavior to thwart any kind of competition. And that's really a function of a failure of policy. It's a failure of enforcement of the law, a failure of enforcement of regulations that should keep our markets open and competitive and keep institutions like Google in check.
So in terms of lobbying, and this applies to all of these tech companies, I mean, we know that Eric Schmidt, I think, visited the Obama White House more than any other single individual. What's happening under Trump? Are they still just as aggressive in terms of lobbying?
Of course. I mean, they have more money and power than they did. But the problem that they are facing now is that
they've lost their mystique. And this is true of Facebook, Amazon, and Google. Before the Trump election in 2016, before that, these institutions were seen as tech companies. They were kind of sorcerers. They had magic. They were cool. And after 2016, 2017, 2018, we've seen, you know, the Russia backdoor, the exploitation of these platforms. They didn't even know what was going on. A lot of these people supported Hillary Clinton, and it turns out that their magic didn't work. So there's been a puncturing of the bubble, even though they have more wealth and today than they did a couple of years ago. They've lost the mystique, and they've lost that sense that they are doing good things for the world. Now they're just very powerful institutions.
So let's talk about the possibility of real antitrust. The Europeans are showing the way. Senator Blumenthal and other Democratic senators are also calling for the FTC to step up to the plate. What's your sense of where we stand over here in terms of antitrust activity?
Well, there was a judicial committee hearing yesterday on the House side, and there was an Energy and Commerce Committee hearing today on the House side. And everyone on both sides of the aisle seemed pretty mad at Facebook. And so, you know, if you take the press, a lot of the tech press kind of doesn't understand Congress. They think that they're stupid or ill-informed. But in fact, you know, if you listen to what they're saying, they're Chairman Goodlatte of the Judiciary Committee, who's a right-wing Republican, immediately started talking about how Facebook has no competition and that's the big problem here. And, you know, you see this Adam Kinzinger today talked about competition, a problem of lack of competition in the economy more broadly. And so you see this, you know, both Republicans and Democrats are frustrated. They're particularly frustrated at the tech companies. So the policymakers have flipped pretty dramatically. The enforcers and the courts, however, on both sides of the aisle, the Democratic and Republican enforcers and courts, are much more skeptical of actually attacking these concentrations of power. But, you know, I think people misunderstand where the policy world is here. There, you know, there's like a pervasive sense of hopelessness, like nothing can be done. But if you actually just listen to what members of Congress are saying, you know, they're pretty much there. They understand the problem. And I think we're going to address this. We're going to address these concentrations of power fairly soon.
But there does seem to be a kind of political double standard in terms of the way that the Trump administration pursues antitrust. They're really going relentlessly after the AT&T Time Warner merger, because apparently, of course, Trump hates CNN. But other mergers, like the one involving Disney and Murdoch, seem to have the White House's blessing. So do you see a double standard there?
Well, I mean, I would say, you know, I'm not willing to say that they went after AT&T just because of CNN. I do think there was a good case there. But yeah, I mean, we have, you know, and you go back to the Obama administration even further, we have a really serious crisis with the rule of law, where law is now used as an arbitrary tool to wield power. And that's something that is incredibly dangerous. And it is a problem that's about 15 years old. And we have a crisis of legitimacy. So even legitimate attempts to constrain power, like the AT&T Time Warner merger, you know, there's a lot of reason, there's a lot of cynicism and skepticism, and I think for good reason. So this is a broader problem. It's a crisis of legitimacy. But we didn't send any Wall Street guys to jail. I mean, how can anybody have faith in our justice system? But we have to restore it, or we won't have a democracy for very much longer. I mean, that's really what we're talking about.
So where is Teddy Roosevelt when you need him?
Oh, Teddy Roosevelt was a fraud. He's a lot like Trump, actually. I mean, I know people love him, but, like, he was not a trustbuster. He didn't like anti. Sorry, I'm studying this stuff.
Right.
We have a history of going down very dark paths and then getting ourselves out. So this is not the first time America's been in really serious trouble. And we can get out of this. We really can.
Well, then let me rephrase that, since Teddy Roosevelt, his reputation doesn't deserve such accolades. What about Ida Tarbell and Mark Twain and others? Is that what we need, more exposure of these big barons and their power?
Well, really what we need to do is, you know, we need to understand our history. So Americans understand that there was a civil war to deal with slavery. But what they don't understand anymore, because it's been written out of history, is that we effectively had kind of a second civil war, but this one was peaceful, really from the in really the 1930s, from the 19-teens to the 1930s, to take down the second group of, I think one could call them masters or slave owners. This was Wall Street. This was the J.P. Morgan world. And these were really dangerous people who were doing very reckless things. And we did take them down and restructure the economy and restore justice. And that's the tradition that we have to get back to. The problem that people have today is that they don't understand that these concentrations of power are as dangerous as anything that we've ever seen in our political economy. And they are, in fact, deeply, deeply antithetical to American traditions. And we have to, through our politics, take back our liberty as citizens. That's the tradition that's missing, and that's what's coming back. And as you know, these tech platforms we're seeing, there's something weird about them, something dangerous, something autocratic that goes beyond just sort of weird technocratic pricing things. That's why you're seeing more skepticism. So we're on our way back. We're reclaiming these traditions, and as a people, we will restore our democracy. I'm pretty confident.
And in terms of the business model of surveillance capitalism, which arguably these big companies, Google and Facebook, operate on, do you think that consciousness is starting to seep into the broader public? In other words, the idea that you are the product, you may think you're getting something for free, but actually you're being monetized and you're not getting anything out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are very uneasy with all of the surveillance. They are very uneasy more broadly with consumer culture. They understand that they are the playthings of powerful forces and they don't like it. At the same time, they like I like being able to fly places. I don't particularly like American Airlines. It's kind of the same way people think about technology. They like being able to find all this cool information and shop for things conveniently. They're not particularly comfortable with the power wielded by these institutions, the political power. So I think, it's complex, but I think people are pretty much there. It's just we need the politicians and the policymakers to begin to wield power again.
And in terms of the politics of power in Silicon Valley, the assumption that Silicon Valley, I guess because it's in a blue state, California, with the world's fifth largest economy, the assumption has always been that it's a fairly liberal, progressive place, or at least the titans are. But we have one Silicon Valley titan putting forth a ballot initiative here in California to split up the state into three states. And it's so cynical and so obvious. If you look at the way he's drawn the map, it will end up here in California with only two Democrats and four Republican senators, which is clearly the design. And of course, once California's broken up, it loses its clout with Detroit, for emission standards, et cetera. And then you've got, recently I learned that Elon Musk has been giving a ton of money to the House and the Tea Party caucus, and you've got Peter Thiel and stuff. So if you were to do a kind of aggregate, where would you say the Zuckerbergs and all these people are in terms of their politics?
Well, they're autocrats. I mean, these people, they see the world and they believe that they should rule. And that, Zuckerberg is progressive in the sense that he thinks he knows what's good for people and he can structure the world to give them what they need, whether they will accept it or not. There's a sort of progressive element to this, which is sort of kind of what you find in a lot of a lot of technocratic elitism. It's not all of progressivism. There's a populist, these guys don't really believe in democracy. But I think one of the problems that Democrats have is that they don't recognize that the problem that we're facing of autocracy actually exists within both parties. So a good chunk of the Democratic Party has this kind of weird libertarian strain that is autocratic, and so does the Republican Party. The people find it hard to see that in the Democratic Party, even though when you look at, say, blue states like California or cities like D.C. or New York, they are the most economically unequal places in the country. So there's an intellectual challenge that we have as a people. It's not just about, red versus blue, Republican, Democrat. It's actually about whether we as a people can regain control of our leadership at every level and within both parties.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to turn to a recent article you wrote, Matt Stoller at BuzzFeed, "The Chinese-Style Digital Dystopia Isn't as Far Away as We Think." And obviously, there is a concern that Silicon Valley cutting-edge technology is being used by the Chinese to repress their people, and there is this phenomenon of social credit score system in China. So, well, first of all, is there any real principle involved here? Are they making a stand against the abuse of technology, surveillance technology in China, for example, or are we going to head the way of China?
Well, so in China, what's happened is the government and private institutions have kind of combining all of the data that they have on people, and then they are making it, they are arranging their pricing algorithms and choices so that if you get placed on certain lists, then you have a harder time, say, buying train tickets or plane tickets, or they're reshaping everything that you see in your digital world based on their political values. It's like you get a credit score here. In China, they take your credit score, but they combine it with everything you say and do and everywhere you go, and then they offer you pricing choices and economic options and opportunities based on what, you know, the score that they get around you with no restrictions. And it's a really scary totalitarian type of system. And a lot of our Silicon Valley kind of oligarchs are really enthralled with that. They think it's incredibly innovative. They see that, well, there's no real restrictions on silly privacy restrictions or kind of old fuddy-duddy fashion rules that prevent us from innovating. And so you're seeing, you know, tremendous interest in Silicon Valley around what China is doing. And then you're also seeing a lot of the lobbying around preventing privacy rules, preventing facial recognition regulation. And some, a lot of the mergers here are designed to basically replicate the storehouses of data and the ability to manipulate people with that data. It's not as advanced as it is in China. It's certainly not connected to the government in the same way. And we live in a democracy. We have a democratic culture. We're a liberal democracy still. But where they want to take us is towards that sort of creepy totalitarian world, which they wouldn't describe as such. They describe it as kind of, they'd have all these economic terms like revealed preferences and perfect pricing, price discrimination to describe it. But what they're effectively talking about is kind of this creepy totalitarian world where your options are presented to you based on this incredible invasive surveillance and these opaque algorithms.
And if you're in any way subversive, you're screwed, right? If you can't buy plane tickets and train tickets.
Well, that's right. That's how it works in China. I mean, that's an explicit political determination. But if you here, it would be the kind of thing like if you return an item to the store, you would get placed on a blacklist that says this person, you know, returns items to stores. And then when you walk into stores, the prices would maybe be higher for you than for other people. You know, that's the kind of thing that would happen. It would change. You wouldn't know that because you would just see the price that you see. But like your options, the world as you see it would differ completely based on your behavior. All of this stuff used to be illegal. It's not possible technically yet, but it's getting there.
Well, Matt Stoller, I thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks a lot.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Stoller, who's a fellow at the Open Markets Institute, who is currently working on a book on monopoly power in the 20th century. Previously, he spent 6 years on Capitol Hill, most recently as a senior policy advisor to the Senate Budget Committee, where he focused on trade, competition policy, and financial services. And in addition to his work on the Hill, he's produced for MSNBC and starred in an FX political comedy show with Russell Brand. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.